had torn it halfway down and then thought better of it. Every traumatic death is a mystery. How close am I to solving yours? What did you see? What did you think? What did you do? What did you write? And if I find it out, can I be absolved? Can I sleep through the night? Can I see a woman your age without imagining it might be you? Can you show me how to bear your death, my life? I walked past the firehouse, the antique store, the town hall, the laundromat, the houses and houses and houses. Landscapes change so slowly when you're on foot. Even this last non-train track, non-highway stretch of my walk couldn't have taken less than 2 hours. My feet had long since stopped registering distinct sensations. I felt like I was walking on stumps of frozen steak. I kept putting my filthy fingers in my mouth to thaw them out. I could feel that something bad was starting to happen around the edges of my ears. A little past Peck's, a white pickup truck stopped next to me. A man in a backward baseball cap leaned out and asked if I was okay. And I don't know what my look conveyed, but he sped off without my having to say a word. I finally turned onto Culver at what must have been close to midnight. There aren't streetlights in Hibernia once you get past the town, so all I could see of things were pale chalk outlines. Road here, fields there, woods as squares of black. If I die of pneumonia, will your parents come to my funeral? Will the firehouse change its sign in my memory? The sleet was making a sound like a thousand tiny drum rolls. The house with the corn crib had its porch lights on. My teeth were chattering, and I discovered that it warmed me up, or maybe just distracted me, if I sung a wavering, continuous vvvv whenever I wasn't talking to myself. So I was droning and digging my fingernails into my palms, thinking pain might help too, when the road took a curve that I knew in the depths of my empty stomach. There was the fallen barn. There were the birch trees. And there, at the top of its hill, faint as a stone through dark water, was the Wright House. The plan I'd worked out, if you can call it a plan, had two parts. I needed to find Hannah's notebook, and I needed to teach myself the ghost-courting technique that Hannah and Jim and Wright had learned. But before I could start on either one, I had some immediate animal needs to take care of. Warmth, hygiene, nourishment. The museum from the outside looked so completely dark, so uninhabited, that it could just as well have been an unusually large shed. The front door was locked, and the key that Hannah and I had taken to hiding on top of the middle porch pillar wasn't there. The windows were locked, too, and in the back of the house, so was the door into the caretaker's apartment. My only consideration, then, was which window to break, and what to do if, when, the alarm went off. I chose a particularly solid piece of firewood from the pile by the side of the house, a piece of wood that would, thanks to having been left out in the rain, have led to the most sputtering and miserable fire, and I walked quietly around to the back door. No neighbor's windows were close enough for them to see me. No cars were on the road. So this, I thought, is how crimes beget crimes. With one satisfying motion, I battering rammed the log end first through the window pane closest to the doorknob, a feeling like bashing a pumpkin with a baseball bat. Then I reached through the window, careful not to scrape my arm, and I let myself in. The alarm wasn't sounding as I relocked the door behind me, and it still wasn't sounding as I peeled off my wet clothes and tossed the soaking fabric heap into the mudroom sink. Just to be safe, I went over to the wall panel and punched in Hannah's all-purpose four-digit code, 2734. There wasn't so much as a flicker of acknowledging light. It took me, despite the alarm, and despite the failure of every light switch I tried, a surprising number of minutes to realize that the house's electricity had been turned off. And it took me longer than it should have after that to realize that this meant that the house wasn't going to have heat, either. It was cold enough inside that my newly exposed skin, I was wearing just my boxers and t-shirt, felt like rotisserie chicken fresh from the refrigerator. I made my way via baby steps and wall padding, and with just one barking of my shin against a low stool, to the closet near Hannah's office, where I thought I remembered seeing the candles and candlesticks we'd used in the spooky Halloween festival. I felt blindly around the shelves, between cardboard boxes and unidentified small appliances, until my fingers encountered a box of cool wax cylinders, and next to them a row of metal candlesticks. Below the candlesticks, on a newspaper and mouse poop stretch of shelf, I felt the bent cardboard contours of an almost empty box of matches. Let there be a creepy sort of light. Holding my candle by the candlestick's too small finger loop, I reacquainted myself with the main part of the house. The shadows cast by the candle flame seemed to vibrate. The furniture, most of it, had been covered in what looked like tattered bedsheets. In the back corner of the parlor, below the row of coat pegs, I found the costume trunk, still rusty-latched, still brimming. Flea-bag coats and cotton shirts and hoop dresses and bonnets. I set my candle on a table and pulled together an outfit that would have embarrassed a 19th-century flasher, and then staggered my way, itching and encumbered, into the caretaker's apartment. My hunger, like a well-behaved child, had waited until it had a reasonable hope of satisfaction to notify me of the urgency of its situation. The only food left in the cabinets, though, the same cabinets that Hannah and I had once filled with almond butter and dry spaghetti and chocolate cherry granola bars, was an ancient box of pancake mix and a slippery canister of olive oil. It required less time than you might think to resign myself to my options. I poured myself the most revolting sort of mouth pancake. 3 parts dry pancake mix, 1 part rancid olive oil, and I swallowed the paste down greedily. I repeated this process, coughing and gagging, until I'd emptied both box and canister. My plan had been to sleep on our old bare mattress in the caretaker's apartment, but the room seemed somehow to be even colder than the rest of the house. I now remembered Hannah saying something about us needing to buy a space heater. So I wandered back out into the museum, a divining rod in search of warmth. Not the kitchen exhibit, not the entryway, not the living room. I creaked and shuffled my way up the stairs to the second floor, carrying my candle like a brimming bowl of soup. The top stair creaked and I nearly brained myself when I tripped on the landing. Not the storage room, not the children's bedroom. Not the exhibit room in which the cases stood empty and the wall signs still promised a look at Wright's famous encyclopedias. I'm not sure if it was my imagination or the warmth that overcomes a person at a certain point in his descent into delirium, but in Edmund and Sarah's bedroom, finally, I thought I felt a type of cold that had a slightly less painful edge to it. I touched the bed, remembered the styrofoam peanuts, and yanked off the period quilt, bringing with it a cloud of dust that I could taste. For a second I just stood there, my heart racing, the quilt heaped at my feet, and took in my situation. This is where you are. This is the moment to which your particular life has delivered you. I curled up on the little hooked rug at the foot of the Wright's bed, using the quilt as mattress, blanket, and, thanks to some creative folding, pillow. I certainly wasn't warm, but I was covered, which is the next best thing. I had set the candle on the floor next to my head, near enough that I could feel or imagine that I was feeling some of its heat. I didn't want to blow it out yet, because I'd forgotten to bring the matches upstairs, and I wasn't ready to consign myself to a night of total darkness. So I just watched the flame wobble and limbo for a while. But I bolted awake after some number of minutes and realized that the only thing worse than being woken up by the police would be to be woken up by an inferno. So I blew the candle out, watched the wick tip fade, smelled birthday party. Dear God, it was so dark. What did you do? What am I doing? What have I done? The only sound was the rain on the roof, and a whispering I very much hoped was just blood rushing in my ears. And this, despite my having resolved not to start in on my ghost work until the morning, was when the first mental channel slippage happened. The only way I can describe it is to say that at some point, as I lay there, I started flickering into lives that weren't mine. I was touching the iron railing of a bridge, and then I was back on the floor in the Wrights' bedroom. I was leaning forward over a messy desk, and then I was myself again, panting under my quilt. I don't know how long I lay there, passing in and out of ordinary consciousness, but it was long enough for me to formulate a prayer. If this is anything like what Jim experienced, then I don't think I'm ready for it. I may just have to die. At one point I sat upright, certain I'd heard a knocking on the wall by the closet. At another point I spent a good 5 minutes deliberating about whether to get up and pee. I felt increasingly aware with each second that passed of how little padding there was between my hip bones and the floor. I kept getting whiffs of mold or mildew or dead animal. The last coherent thought I remember having before I finally sunk into an unrefreshing sleep was, am I, this trembling, hallucinating ball of sinew, really any stranger of a creature, any more improbable of an object than a ghost?
From Edmund Wright, The Encyclopedia of Ordinary Human Sensation, Volume 2, Pleasures, edited by Lydia Gibbons. The sudden stoppage of a meddlesome sound, viz., the newsboy's shouts, or a team of horses' hooves. The near-certain knowledge derived from certain atmospheric and behavioral clues that one's partner intends to fulfill the act of coitus. The sensation in one's extremities when initially settling into bed, after a day that has been trying, whether physically or intellectually or emotionally, or any combination thereof. The singing of a pure and muscular note, quite precisely inhabiting the pitch one intended. The minority of dreams, viz., dreams of hearing a most hilarious joke, which hilarity nearly invariably fails to translate into one's waking senses. Dreams in which one composes music, or speaks an unknown language, or in any other way demonstrates a heretofore unsuspected creative faculty. Dreams of sexual fulfillment with a proper and intended partner. Dreams of transformation, either of one's own body or of external objects, into shapes that are both pleasing and contain the element of inevitability. The realization that one has, in the course of one's researches, arrived at the moment when one's fundamental question shall be answered imminently.
Two. One of Hannah's more durable and justified complaints about me when we were together was that I didn't know how to look for things. I would, standing in front of a refrigerator featuring multiple bottles of mustard, insist that we were out. I would pillage the apartment in search of a pair of glasses that were resting on the edge of the bathroom sink. Alone in the museum that next morning, I was determined to do better. I didn't quite have Jim's faith that Hannah had hidden her notebook in the house. It seemed just as likely to be at the bottom of Donna's box or at the bottom of the river. But my operating principle at that point was to do anything that had even the slightest chance of bringing me closer to her. So I started out in the main parts of the house, dividing each room into quadrants like an archaeologist. This was, incidentally, a search conducted entirely with the curtains drawn, and with a good quarter of my attention absorbed in listening for tires on the driveway or footsteps on the porch. I was still wearing the loose white shirt and wool coat from the costume trunk. I looked under the carpets, inside drawers, underneath dressers. I lifted cushions from armchairs and took books off of shelves. I was, by the time I'd been at it for an hour or so, In that same state of desperation and mounting despair, as if I'd been looking for my passport in the minutes before needing to leave for a trip. There was nothing but printer cartridges and dry pens in Hannah's old office. Nothing but broken-down shelving in the closet across from the stairs. In the storage room upstairs, underneath a stack of blank teacher evaluation forms, I found a torn piece of Wright House notepaper with Hannah's handwriting on it. My blood briefly froze, but it was just an 845 phone number in the beginning of a shopping list. What had I been thinking? The museum was almost as cold now as it had been at night. I could feel my hopelessness, my sense of being fundamentally doomed and delusional, threatening to swallow me up. Fearing that you've lost your mind turns out to be no more romantic and no easier to bear than fearing that you have bowel cancer. I spent most of that afternoon on the couch downstairs in the parlor, trying to convince myself that my ghost work might go better than my notebook hunting. Make yourself receptive, had been Jim's instruction. Relax your muscles and turn your mind into an empty room. So I sat there, watching the light change on the floorboards, pleading with Hannah to help me, feeling my face break into tears and then reassemble itself. How are you supposed to relax when every breeze sounded like a knock at the door and every inch of your body ached? How are you supposed to empty your mind when you couldn't stop looking at the crack between the curtains? Hannah, I muttered, if what I'm doing has the slightest chance of succeeding, if I'm not just falling apart, please show me how. Please show me something. But no one appeared and nothing happened. I only realized how long I'd been sitting there and how easily I could have stayed sitting there forever when I saw that the room was now dark enough that I was going to need another candle soon, which meant that it had been more than 24 hours since I'd eaten a real meal. I considered briefly breaking into a neighbor's house, maybe the family down Culver with the softball tee, and emptying out their fridge. Or maybe walking back into town, seeing what I could steal from the bins by the farm stand. The plan I eventually settled on, though, and I can't vouch for my decision-making in this period, was to see if I could find anything edible in the museum's garden. I'd seen Hannah pull up some knobby little carrots once, and I remembered watching her plant some knuckle-sized potato pieces at some point that fall. Even in the winter, didn't there have to be at least something under there? My mouth actually watered at the thought of half-frozen vegetable stubs. My knowledge of harvest cycles was as spotty as my knowledge of the spirit world. So I scurried out to the garden plot, prepared to flee back inside if I spotted anyone. This was my first venture into open air since coming back to the museum. The sky was silver mixed with gray, and the wind bit directly into the square inch of chest where my shirt was missing a button. The ground was hard, but not, I found when I leaned over, completely frozen. Here was the deer fence around the garden that Butch and I had spent a sunny afternoon building. Here were the beams that Hannah and I had dragged off a pickup truck for the raised beds. With a spade from the shed, I started scraping away at the first plot. I had my shirt sleeve pulled down over my hand instead of a glove. Eventually, I uncovered some dead and frozen sage leaves. But one nibble revealed that they were too miserable even for me. The second plot had been overtaken entirely by a woody, reddish vine that kept snagging on my pants. In the third plot, under a mound still marked with weathered popsicle sticks, I found my first hope of sustenance, a scattering of tiny, filthy potatoes that, collectively, couldn't have weighed a pound. I held the entire harvest, which I quickly realized included a couple of potato-colored rocks, in my cupped hands. I won't go into the trouble it took me to build a fire in the fireplace, or the process by which I convinced myself that it was now dark enough and that the fire would be small enough that no passers-by would notice the smoke curling out of the chimney. I'll just say that these potatoes, roasted to the edge of edibility in a historic cast-iron pot, were more precious to me than any restaurant meal I'd ever eaten. No wonder our ancestors were so hardy. Every calorie was once wrested from the earth like a prisoner of war. I was going through some old binders in Hannah's office after dinner, newly fortified and perhaps lulled into a mild state of slackness by my potatoes, when I heard from the front of the house what sounded very much like gravel crunching and an engine turning off. For a few seconds I sat holding my breath, considering blowing out my candle, wondering whether this could be another hallucination. Hours of anxiously awaiting something do not, it turns out, make the arrival of that thing any less alarming. I shrank back in my chair, and here, before I could think what to do next, were human voices. And now, here were footsteps on the porch. I grabbed my candle and, cupping the flame, raced down the stairs into the basement. When Hannah and I had lived in the museum, I had avoided the basement at all costs. It was my every atavistic terror in the form of a room. The staircase consisted of unmoored 2x4s. The floor was cold dirt. The walls were stone, meaning made from actual irregular stones. The ceiling, fiberglass and rusty pipes, was low enough that you had to hunch. And it was now, since even the bulb with the chain didn't work, as dark as the inside of a coffin. I went and crouched by the boiler, which was as cold as something dead, and focused on making my breathing quiet. My candle made a ball of light that illuminated nothing but my shaking hands. The whole room seemed to swim with evil. And I could hear, as if I were below the floorboards at a theater, someone knocking at the front door, then muffled voices, then more knocking. And after a minute, with no warning, and this is when my heartbeat became loud enough that I worried it might be audible through the floor, I heard footsteps inside the house. I'd forgotten the precise terror of being it in hide-and-seek. The voices, there were two male voices, one of them vaguely familiar, sounded much less distinct than the footsteps. I could hear every heel strike and board creak as whoever it was walked from the front hall into the caretaker's apartment and then back into the living room. Their conversation was strangely sparse, a calm, professional sort of talk. After a couple of minutes, I heard the familiar voice say, "Did you get this?" And I listened as one of them shifted something heavy, cursing myself for not having cleaned up my potato dinner. This went on, this Foley performance of footsteps and pauses and half-audible conversation, for what felt like an hour, but really couldn't have been more than 20 minutes. At some point, one or both of them went up to the second floor, and the sounds got more distant for a while. My fingers were covered in dribbles of white wax. The seat of my pants was either wet or just very cold. When the footsteps came back down to the first floor, I heard the familiar voice make a joke. It sounded like, "Corn money?" And then the other one answer with a short, unamused laugh. The footsteps were directly overhead now, so close that I worried they might hear my candle sputtering. They weren't saying anything. A walkie-talkie or something crackled. And then, just at the moment when I was sure they were going to burst into the basement, I decided I would fling myself to the ground and cover my head with my coat. I heard someone opening the front door of the house. There was a crescendo of footsteps, a few indiscernible words, and then the front door closing with a forcible bang. Had that really happened? All I could hear now was my breathing. They were gone, just as if they'd never been there at all. This was another hide-and-seek feeling that I'd forgotten. I stayed there, twitching in the dark for a few minutes, in case they were just circling the house, and by the time I finally decided I was safe, enough time had passed, and I had been in a sufficiently uncomfortable position that getting to my feet was going to require a series of slow-motion maneuvers. I set my candle on the dirt by the boiler, turned onto my hands and knees, and discovered that my feet were the kind of asleep that makes any movement impossible. So I stayed still for a minute, pounding my throbbing feet against the ground, massaging my calves, and when I looked up, I spotted something in the wavering circle of candlelight. It was tucked between the boiler and the wall a few inches off the ground. My first thought was a user's manual, "Boilers for Dummies," dropped by some long-ago handyman. I extended an arm in a geriatric yoga pose. The pages, I found as I pried them out from the gap where they'd been crammed, were crushed in at one corner, stained with something damp. It was a notebook with a black and white speckled cover.
Edmund Wright's journal. December 8. How peculiar that the plainest human life, with its innumerable pleasures and pains, its ceaseless vulnerability, the endless sense of having almost but not quite attained some crucial, unnameable thing, its inevitable end. How very odd that this most common of conditions can, from a certain angle of perception, seem the material for a tale of such surpassing cruelty that not even the most gothic of authors would.
3. I deliberated for a ridiculously long time about where to read Hannah's notebook. When someone can't summon the courage to do something, acts of preparation take on special significance. It was pitch black out by the time I came up from the basement, and for a long time I just paced around the house with my candle and the notebook like a lunatic in a Poe story. I settled on Hannah's storage room upstairs, finally. A part of me, I realized, had the feeling that I was about to betray her and to go into this room, the room that I associated so strongly with everything that had happened to her, felt like an act of pre-absolution. I would baptize myself in her aura. So I settled in with her notebook in the spot where she used to sit, on the little red cushion on the floor by the window. All around me were binders and boxes and stray bits of curiosity shop garbage, a folded flag, a copper eagle, a waist-high jumble of empty picture frames. I put my candle on an empty stretch of windowsill. I held a pencil from her desk downstairs in case I needed to make notes. The room, in the candlelight, was the color of the inside of a tent with soft-edged shadows. It gets hard at a certain point to tell what sounds are coming from inside your head. I heard buzzing and shaking and a high, wavering whine. In order to see the page, I had to hold the notebook up close to the candle with my left hand, so my posture as I read had a strange, supplicating quality to it, like a priest with a crucifix. The first pages, sparsely written, seemed to be just ordinary work stuff. Call J.M. re 1022 event. 24 people. Chairs? Find out when we did cooking exhibition 2009 and 2010. Conference call Tuesday at 4:30. Dial in number 458-9785. Tell D. Get toothpicks, cups, dirt, Macos? Hannah, I thought. Sweet, sane, conscientious Hannah. Could this really have been you? Have I really been chasing after something this unmysterious? Maybe Dr. Mittal's good enough story, that Hannah had succumbed to a mental illness no more otherworldly than a stroke, and that the only complications were in my imagination, really had been true. But a few pages in, after a blank page and then a few that had been torn out, these, it occurred to me, might be the lists I'd been carrying in my pocket, things started to get weird. You are sitting on a low wall beside your sister in a park. Your toes reach the ground. You're wearing a white shirt, puffed sleeves, short purple shorts. Your shoes are cheetah patterned. A gnat is struggling to enter your nose. Your sister says, I've never seen Mom that pissed. You make a noise. You don't know whether it means you don't believe her or you don't care. That was all that was written on one page. The handwriting was still Hannah's, but different somehow, more fluid. I made a meaningless line in the margin. My heart had started to pound. I turned a couple of pages ahead. You are in the back seat, green car. A blonde boy is driving, pressing stereo buttons, large square fingers, The girl next to you is smoking out the window. You see the moon low and red over the CVS. You feel suddenly like crying, but instead you cough. And a few pages after that, you are lying sideways on a twin bed with rumpled sheets. The room is dark. There's another girl on the bed across the room who is doing something with her bare feet against the wall hanging. Oberlin, learning and labor. A boy is on the floor between you, resting his head. You know he would like to kiss you. He has been looking for opportunities all night. The lights are off. The speakers are balanced on a milk crate. The entries were getting longer and longer. Some of them were multiple pages now, but I was, for whatever reason, only capable of reading a few lines at a time. I felt like I was racing through a gauntlet of sharpened spears. You are standing in spotted shade. You are facing your husband. He is almost your husband. Your friends, your family are sitting in chairs on logs. They are fanning themselves. Your grandmother, tiny and ancient, is perched in the first row. The rabbi is going on too long. You are walking down a brick path. Your hand is trailing on a black metal gate. You are watching your baby. He is squatting in rubber boots, white wrinkles of diaper fat, pale thighs. He is digging for something in the dirt, his little nails. The sprinkler is turning slowly over dry hostas. You are sitting in a hard chair next to your dad, who is in a high beige plastic bed. Your mom is by the window. Other buildings, rows of windows, the 19th floor. She says to no one, this is absolutely ridiculous. These windows must have been designed by Rube Goldberg. If my skin had been attached to sensors, the temperature readout would now have fallen below freezing. My body, some animal thing in me, had worked out already what all this was. You are standing at a metal sink in a white kitchen, scrubbing a pan that won't come clean. The party is still going. You hear the laughter like a lapping tide. You hear your husband's voice, come in here. You watch the water turn white. You scrub until your fingers ache. You are propped up in a small bed. The sheets are tight around your legs. A nurse leans towards you with a spoon, says, come on now, you've got to eat. You tighten your lips. She pries them open. Your throat is dry. The food tastes like something you can't remember. She says, that's it. That's right. You close your eyes. My brain had now caught up with my body. The feeling was like an elevator reaching the ground floor too fast. That sickening thud. These were Hannah's stories. This was Hannah's life. That wedding was the wedding we would have had. That baby was the baby we would have had. I can't explain how clearly this all came to me, how simple it seemed. It was as if something were pushing me toward the realization, and maybe something was. Your girlfriend was possessed by spirits, and night after night, while you slept downstairs oblivious, she wrote out the story of her life. Spirits would show you a vision that would drive you insane, Jim had said. And here it was. Your past and future laid out before you like a book. I don't know how many times I read through the notebook. Once I understood, I was fully sobbing now, so the words kept disappearing into a blur. Here was our first dance. Here was our son discovering his feet. Here was Hannah plucking her eyebrows in front of a hotel mirror. Here was her 50th birthday party on the deck of a boat. Here was the morning in line at the airport. Here was the nursing home. Are we going to be okay? Are we going to have a happy life? I kept wiping my eyes with my sleeve, senselessly repeating Hannah's name. So this was the horror that had overtaken her. This was the vision she hadn't known how to bear. Do you ever get scared just of being alive? She'd asked me once, mid-breakdown. I'd asked her what she meant, but by then the window had closed. It was too late. For a while, sitting there in the storage room, I tried to write down my best guesses at places and dates next to each entry, to impose some kind of order on the flood that was swallowing me. But by the third or fourth time through, I'd given up and was just making lines, little dashes of protest and heartbreak. My nose was running freely to my lips. My candle had burned down to a puddly stub. Finally, when I didn't think I could read through it another time, I sat back against the wall, limp, with the notebook open to the last page in my lap. The shadows now covered almost the entire walls. My muscles were relaxed, in the way that someone's muscles are relaxed after a lobotomy. My mind was empty, in the way a town square is empty after an atomic bombing. And so, if I'd been capable of thinking clearly, I wouldn't have been surprised by what happened next. My body started to fill up with something both strange and deeply cellularly familiar. I felt both terrified and liquidly calm. I was, I realized, some part of me was, not myself. I was Hannah, walking across a field at dawn. The rest of me, still on the floor with a pencil in my hand, sat up and began to write. I walked out of the house across the field. I was barefoot. The sun hadn't risen. I had made up my mind. I was so tired. I was afraid. I couldn't find the courage to live my life. I crossed the hills. This is the last grass, the last sky, the last morning. I came to the riverbank. The sun was almost up. The trees were still wet. I dragged the canoe, red and heavy, down through the grass, pushed it out into the water, upside down. I wanted you to be okay. I wanted you to think I had been okay. Now the air was aerosol. The sky was scraps of cloud. The edge of the river was reeds. Cold, mud. I walked out barefoot. God, it was cold. Not as cold as the air, somehow. I kept taking steps. The water to my knees, then my thighs. I did have second thoughts. I did shiver. I could still feel where you'd touched me finally, my waist finally deep enough that to go deeper I'd need to swim. Cold is just sensation. I raised my arms, plunged forward. Something screamed, no, but something else lowered my head under the surface. The water was dark green-brown, the river was deeper than I thought. Faster. I told myself not to fight. I was in a new sort of space. I would forget, and then remember, and then forget, and then it was like falling asleep. I could feel my thoughts turn strange. I couldn't remember the last time I'd breathed. I felt my mind nestling into something. I couldn't find the surface. With every second, I knew it would be harder to break out. Something in me wanted to break out. Something else was so content. I let myself sink and sink. I swallowed water, freezing mud. Pain is just sensation. My lungs didn't hurt anymore. I was slipping down and down. Regret is just sensation. My body wasn't me anymore. I was leaving and leaving, and then it was just a scarecrow that drifted down, got caught on a branch. I'm sorry, I was already gone. Already here. The pain was gone. I didn't know there are worse things than pain. Didn't know I would be trapped here. Nick? Every day and night I live my death. I walk into the water. I've waited for you. Please help me. I don't know how, but Wright did. Please help me. Please help me. Please. By the time I woke up with Hannah's notebook in my lap, I must have fallen asleep or anyway into some sort of state in which time didn't register. The sun was already going down again. My mouth was so dry that I could feel all the slight sandpaper variations inside. My body was excruciatingly stiff, and not just from having spent the past however many hours sitting up against a wall. I thought honestly that I might be dead, and that these might be the sensations I was stuck with for all time. The memory of having been Hannah had already slipped behind a dark curtain, as if I'd been under anesthesia. I stood up, propelled like a sleepwalker or a risen corpse, and stumbled my way downstairs. I didn't have a candle anymore, so I was navigating mainly by leaning against the wall. I made my way out the front door onto the porch. There was a thin line of paler cloud behind some hills where the sun was setting, and I understood, from the way the wind hit my skin and my head ached, that I was in fact alive, however feebly. I knelt down and drank a few freezing hand cups of filthy water from the culvert next to the driveway, There was no one else out, but walking out onto the road, turning right at the stop sign, starting almost at a jog along the gravel shoulder up the hill, I knew I wouldn't have cared even if someone was. I don't think I could have directed someone else to Butch's house. I'd only been there a couple of times when he worked at Wright. And I don't think I was conscious either of why my legs were carrying me there. This plan must have been hatched while I was asleep, or wherever I'd been. My mind had been stirred like a drink, and the ice cube that was now bobbing on the surface was one I'd forgotten about completely. Buried, not burned. So I walked up Cold Spring and left on Amenia, and then back into the little tract of houses on the dirt loop that didn't have a name. A tall gray dog was going insane behind an electric fence. A black horse in a plaid jacket was standing staring from the top of a hill. My ordinary consciousness was slowly coming online, and I thought it must have been close to 5 o'clock now. I was aware, walking across the little yard and up the couple of cement steps to Butch's front door, that I might present an alarming sight. His wife answered the door. I knew it was his wife, despite never having met her. She had a long, hawkish, wary face, and she wore a black turtleneck. She called for Butch, and he came to the door in a dark green work shirt and stained jeans. His hair was grayer than I'd remembered, or maybe I just wasn't used to seeing him without a hat. I could hear the TV on somewhere behind him. He looked surprised, but in no real way distressed to see me. He told his wife to bring me a glass of water, and while I drank it, he put a hand on my shoulder. I don't know if this was to stabilize me physically or mentally, and then gave me a look that meant, well? He kept glancing off over my shoulder as if I might have been trailed. I told him, in what must have been the clumsiest and least lucid string of sentences ever assembled, what it was I needed to do.
"And you're sure this'll do something for you?" he said.
"I think so." He nodded, nodded again, and then went to the closet for his coat. A person's quality is inversely proportional to the quantity of explanation he demands before agreeing to help a friend in need. It was Butch's idea, once we were in his truck, for us to pick up his son. Bryce might have some better tools, Butch said. Plus, he was stronger than either one of us. There was an apple in a bag on the dashboard. This might have been another provision from his wife, and while we drove, Butch insisted that I eat it. I had to stop myself from eating the core. Bryce only lived 5 minutes away in a one-story house with an above-ground plastic pool in the yard. He climbed into the car after a short conversation with Butch and a rummage through his own truck. I hadn't been in this car, I realized, or seen Butch's son since the day we'd found Hannah. Those hands of Bryce's had been the first ones to touch her. None of us talked, except to murmur slightly when a deer ran across the road. We pulled into the driveway at Wright, the flatbed clattering with shovels, just at the point when it was getting cold enough to see your breath. I led them back through the yard and into the woods, and over to the clearing where the Wrights were buried. The ground was covered in feathery gray leaves. The gravestones looked like crooked front teeth.
"So, we're gonna do this," Bryce said.
It wasn't really a question, but I nodded. "I don't know how, but Wright did. Please help me. Please."
"Well," Butch said, "something's needed doing for a long time."
He went and pulled his truck into the yard so he could shine his headlights on our work. Bryce disappeared for a while, and then came back with a pickaxe, a cluster of shovels, and a few pairs of yellow work gloves. If your only experience with hole digging comes from sandcastle moats or from burying tulip bulbs, then you can't possibly understand what it was like digging our way to Wright's coffin. The ground was almost frozen, for one thing, which meant that once we'd cleared away the leaves, we spent the first couple of hours of work, hours, smashing away at the grave with the pickaxe and shovels. Having never held a pickaxe before, this was, for a few minutes, satisfyingly brutal work. But cold ground, especially cold ground embedded with roots and stones, is an astonishingly unyielding substance. We pounded and pounded, dug and dug, and only communicated via grunts and nods, shifting around each other occasionally, kneading our arms, flexing our hands. For the first time in days, I wasn't cold. I had taken off my wool coat and pushed the sleeves of my shirt up almost to my shoulders. Butch's shirt was soaked with sweat. Bryce had taken off both of his shirts. His physique was like a carny's somehow. And now steam was rising off of his actual skin. Still, by 9 o'clock, when the moon was racing to the peak of the sky like a white balloon someone had lost hold of, we had succeeded only in making a hummocky mess of the grave's top layer. By 10, we had dug out maybe another foot, and I had done something to my right shoulder that sent a searing, unmistakably nerve-related pain across the entire length of my back with every stroke. But desperation, the conviction that someone you love's well-being depends on your finishing, is an astonishing taskmaster. I thought I'd known determination from music, or from college papers written the night before they were due, but these had been nothing. Christmas lights beside bonfires. So with my burning shoulder, and with popped blisters underneath both of my gloves, and with Butch and his son working just as hard on either side of me, I dug. And dug and dug. There's a hypnotic aspect to any action that you repeat for long enough. I was actually in more pain, I realized, whenever I stopped digging. The hole was taking on an impressive shape, with walls that barely tapered. It was midnight, and then it was 1 in the morning, and we were down, finally, in the heart of the ground, deep enough that someone could have hurt themselves by stumbling in. And we were getting better at it, too. I was, anyway. Sometimes I stabbed the point of the shovel into the wall of the hole in order to dislodge a rock or to cut through a root. Sometimes I focused on flinging out the backfill. The ground gets softer after the first few feet, it turns out. And body pain transforms itself eventually into a scary sort of lightness. Not that it ever became easy, exactly. But just that exhaustion stopped being something I was struggling against, and started being the mildly acidic substance in which I was floating. I was in a kind of fugue when Butch finally said, "I think we've got to stop for the night." His son was up at the truck, drinking something from a thermos. We climbed out, Butch pulled me by the wrist, and we were standing near the edge of the woods when Butch said he wanted to tell me something. I thought, from the way he was looking at me, that he might be about to hug me. "Hannah asked me a question a week before she died," he said, "about the Kemps. Said she wanted to know if I knew anything more about what happened. I told her I didn't." I nodded. "It wasn't true," he said. He wasn't looking at me while he spoke. "I never told anybody this. A little bit before Mrs. Kemp disappeared, my brother told me something that one of the Kemp girls, Marjorie, had told him. Mrs. Kemp had started seeing her future, he told me, having visions every night of herself as an old lady. It was driving her crazy, Marjorie said. I should have told Hannah that." "It's," I started to say, meaning to express that it was okay, that it wouldn't have made any difference, that he'd done enough. But he wouldn't hear of it. Bryce appeared from the other side of the truck and draped his t-shirt over his shoulder before giving me, or the grave, a half-salute. Butch plunged his shovel into the dirt as if it were a bayonet. They both shook my hand and climbed in the car. I never really considered giving up for the night after they pulled away. I understood, I think, that I was down to my last days or even hours at the museum, and so I'd better not put anything off. My shoulder had stiffened up just in the time that I'd been standing by their truck, so I had to do most of the rest of the digging with my left arm. It was harder to see without Butch's headlights, but I knew the hole more or less by feel now. I would work at one end for half an hour, and then move over and even things up at the other. There was much less left to do than I would have thought anyway. I wondered if Butch had somehow known this. My shovel tapped wood for the first time, just before it started to get light out, or just when the darkness started to have an edge of blueness to it that I guess was the pre-roll for its getting light out. The hole couldn't have been much deeper than 4 feet by then, so at first I thought it was another rock, an enormous, smooth rock that I would now have to lever out, jumping and jumping on my blade. But I leaned closer, and I saw the grain of the wood, the splinteriness of it, and I had to struggle not to fall over. It took until full-on sunrise, an oil spill of color behind the woods, for me to get the coffin's whole surface exposed. It was a no-nonsense coffin, solid as an oak door with black metal handles on the sides. I tossed my shovel up out of the pit. Until right that minute, I realized, I hadn't fully reckoned with what I was going to do. It turns out that you can distinguish the heart racing caused by exertion and the heart racing caused by terror even when both are going on simultaneously. I pried open the lid. It came away easier than I expected because the hinges had fallen off. And the first thing that struck me was the smell, which was intense, complicated, yellow somehow, but not unbearable, just dense with the information that I shouldn't be there. I was standing straddling the coffin now, leaning down over it like it was some sort of horrible bassinet. It was full of brown, stringy tatters, a whole layer of them, and it took me a minute to realize that these must have been Wright's clothes, or a fabric that he'd been wrapped in. I wondered if his body had somehow been shredded too, if this was all that was left of him. I was breathing hard and entirely through my mouth. I dug gently through the tatters for a minute, an activity like clearing away packing peanuts. And then I froze. Even through gloves, it was unmistakable. I'd touched bone. I've thought since then how it is that I don't have a better visual memory of that first moment of glimpsing Wright's body, his skeleton. But it was still semi-dark down there, and I was averting as much of my attention as it was possible to do without actually closing my eyes. I do remember the position of his hands, right over left, and the surprising length of his finger bones. And I remember accidentally shifting him at one point, nudging him with the back of my hand and realizing that his body, what there was of him, was as light as if it had been made of straw. But I barely had to touch his body once I'd finished clearing the tatters away, because there, beside his head, all I remember about the skull is the size of the eye sockets, was a long wooden box with a brass pattern inlaid. I knew, the thing that had been steering me all night knew, that this was what I'd been looking for. With the box in my hands, it was covered in a thick gray dust that I realized might not have been dust. I started scrabbling my way out of the hole, and only then did I allow myself to feel the full horror of where I was and what I was doing. I imagined the dirt sliding in on me. I imagined one of those bony hands shooting out to grab my ankle. But the unprofessionality of my digging, the many dirt chunks and half-roots I'd left in place, made for relatively easy climbing. I used my elbows to brace myself against the lip of the hole. Like a grave robber, actually there's no like about it, covered in sweat and dirt and God knows what else, I climbed out into the cold, gray dawn.
Wright's Famous Encyclopedias, Classroom Activity, Wright Historic House Teaching Materials. 1. Can you list 5 experiences from your own life that were painful? Please be as detailed as possible. After 5 minutes, have 3 students read aloud items from their lists. 2. Can you list 5 experiences from your own life that were pleasurable? Please be as detailed as possible. After 5 minutes, have 3 students read aloud items from their lists. 3. What do you notice about the painful and pleasurable experiences that you have just heard your classmates share? Were any of the items the same? Do you think any 2 people would have exactly the same lists as each other? Call on 3 to 4 students. 4. Why do you think someone would decide to make lists like these? Did writing your lists make you feel silly? Happy? Scared? Call on 3 to 4 students. 5. Based on what you learned today, do you think that Edmund Wright felt more pain or more pleasure in his life? Do you think most people's lists, if they worked on them for as long as he did, would look like his? Call on 3 to 4 students.
4. I spent that entire day from sunrise to sunset reading. Except reading doesn't seem like an adequate word to convey the involvement of it. I was prying apart decomposing pages, studying lines of faded ink, filling up the blank parts of Hannah's notebook with notes of my own. The box from Wright's coffin had been full, as I'd hoped it would be, with notebooks, ones with blueboard covers just like the ones in the display cases upstairs. For hours I lay there on the wood floor in the parlor by the fireplace. I'd built another smoky little fire, getting closer to Wright than any writer had ever been. The story that the notebooks told was discontinuous. Notes, with pages missing, were tucked between letters from years earlier. Random scraps of journal entries were scattered throughout. But I was able to piece it together, for the most part. The papers had kept surprisingly well in their box, much better than his body had. Making sense of the handwriting was probably the biggest hurdle, and that turned out to be less a matter of word-by-word deciphering than of making some magic eye-like inner adjustment, and then just trusting my intuition. I read Wright's accounts of first being visited by his son's spirit, then the many nights after. I read his journal entries, and his letters to his brother, and his notes to his wife. I arranged things in chronological piles whenever I could. I read the notes Wright had written to other scientists, begging for their interest. I read the many notes he'd made to himself about developing a unified model of the spirit world, all of which read like some combination of mythology, reincarnation, ghosts, enchanted objects, and botany, cycles, mechanisms, reactions. And then, finally, in the very last notebook, in an entry dated just 3 days before Wright's death, I read, with papers stacked everywhere around me like a deranged student, the passage that I'd been looking for. It seems plain to me now that spirits long for nothing so much as to be freed back into the cycle of reincarnation, so that they might resume the proper dance of generations in which the rest of us are engaged. Their attempts to achieve this freedom by inducing despair in the living are, of course, monstrous. Had I the will remaining to pursue it, I would seek out a more benign means of granting them their desire. Among the most promising avenues for exploration seems to me one that may prove rash and impracticable, the wholesale destruction of the setting that lately they haunted. When I stood up, it was already dark out. I didn't so much come up with a plan as I did discover that one was already there. It didn't take me long to gather everything I cared about saving. Hannah's notebook, most of Wright's papers, a couple of things from the house. I laid them all in a pile in the center of the quilt from upstairs and tied it into a sloppy bundle. I didn't feel possessed, but I did feel determined, certain, slightly outside of myself. So this was why I'd come back. The police were wrong about how the fire got started. At first, I just made a torch with a rolled-up piece of newspaper from the basket by the hearth. Then I walked around the room, to the curtains, the green sofa, the yellow wall hanging, tap, tap, tap. It felt like using a magic wand. Except the fire didn't really catch at first. The curtains and wall hanging just smoked and smoldered. So that was when I employed an accelerant, which is to say, remembered the lighter fluid in the garden shed. Setting a fire, deliberately setting a fire that you mean to get out of control, is so strange and in a way so satisfying. It feels, I imagine, something like urinating all over the floors and walls, or stomping through a palace in muddy shoes, a childish satisfaction, all rules suspended. With the bottle of lighter fluid, I walked around the house squirting patterns on the walls, the furniture, the floor. The liquid was lighter than water somehow, almost weightless. And that smell, baseball team barbecues, fat dads sitting around in Father's Day t-shirts. Within seconds of my touching the newspaper torch to the trail of lighter fluid on the dining room floor, the curtains were covered in blue flames. And small fires converge into large fires. This was another surprise to me. It was noisy, like a pack of animals chomping their way through the bones of the house. The walls and the